Okay, hopefully I activated the right mic. I guess that's working. Okay, welcome to our second lecture in KDD this semester. Before we start with the content of today's lecture, are there any more questions regarding last week? One pretty common question in the forum via mail and also via other channels was how to change exercise group. You are able to change your exercise group by leaving your existing exercise group or joint exercise group and joining another exercise group. As long as there's enough place in these exercise groups, you can change them as you like. So no worries about that. Again, the short reminder, I will not answer emails or messages through other channels. Please use the forum, because then I do not have to answer them multiple times. In the forum, everybody can see the answers. That's a big advantage. Okay, with that said, let's start with today's lecture. Today's lecture is about data. Data is honestly the most important part of KDD, because without data, we can't start getting knowledge out of that data. Today, we will start by talking about some basics about data. There are different kinds of data we can work with. Then we will talk about some basic statistical descriptors. Most of them should be known to you already, because most of you are data science students. At the maths department, you should know statistical descriptors of data. We will talk about some basic data visualization techniques, and we will also talk about data similarity and data dissimilarity. Let's start with data objects and attribute types. We already talked about there being a lot of different kinds of data that we can mine in data mining. The most common kind of data we can mine are, of course, relational data sets. So relational data sets are divided in columns and rows. Basic. And we have some structure to that. I guess that's pretty basic to understand how we can mine those kinds of data, because we simply use the columns we want to interpret. We can also use numerical data types like matrices or crosstabs. We can also take a look at text documents, because we can transform them into relational data, for example. We can count how often a specific word occurs in the data set. We can use more advanced methods like neural networks to gain some basic descriptors of that document data. We can also mine a specific kind of relational data. That's called a transactional data set, where we have transactions, one transaction per row, and have items. That will become very important in chapter 6, frequent patterns. I hope the numbering is correct, but in the lecture on frequent patterns, those data sets with transaction in them will become pretty important. Because if we buy something from Amazon, from whatever, we create a transaction. We buy multiple products, or even only one product, per transaction. And that's a pretty common occurrence. Of course, there are other types. We already talked about them last week. The World Wide Web is by itself a graph, because we have links between websites spanning a whole web of websites creating the World Wide Web. We have things like Facebook, Twitter, or X, Reddit, and so on, that are all networks, connections between the users may occur. And of course, we have also things like biological structures that can be mined. We will not mine graphs in KDD, but it can be done with some preprocessing. Something that is pretty helpful to be used is ordered data, because if there's a specific ordering to data, we can get or use that ordering to get more knowledge out of the data. Back to the transactional data sets. You might have an explicit ordering, like here. We have a TID, a transaction ID. That's an explicit ordering, of course. But we might also have implicit ordering, like temporal data, where we have simply a timestamp occurring, and we know that 3 p.m. is after 2 p.m., of course. And the same might be true for example, genetic sequences. A biologist might know whether a certain geome is after one other geome. And of course, we also have multimedia data. We will not care about that in KDD, but that can be mined also. One pretty important part of the data we will use, so relational data at most, is that we have some important characteristics. One thing is dimensionality. You can think about a relational data set as multiple dimensions. We have the rows, and those rows have attributes. Each of that attributes is a dimension. So, for example, this relational document has two dimensions. One is the TID, one other items, two dimensions. Most relational data sets, of course, have more than two dimensions. We might have 100 dimensions. We might have 3,000 dimensions. That might occur. And with more dimensions, we get more into the curse of dimensionality, because if there are too many dimensions, very many data science techniques are pretty limited by exponential growth of runtime, for example. We have to compare all those dimensions to each other. That's pretty expensive to do. We might have sparse data, so missing data in the data set. That might also occur. We might have problems with resolution, because some patterns are only visible if you take a look at those data sets in a pretty gray, pretty granular detail level. Some patterns might only occur if you look at that with some distance to that data, so zoomed out of the data. For example, if we take a look at, let's take a look at grades, normal student grades. If you zoom out, we see the grade average from a lecture. Yeah, okay, that's pretty basic. It might occur that on this level, several lectures have a different grade average. And therefore, this is a pattern. Maybe KDD has better grades than ConsMod, which is true. That's a pattern we can only see if we zoom out. But if we zoom in, we might find patterns like specific student groups performing better or worse. like students visiting the exercise performing better than students not visiting the exercise that's zoomed in. That's basically what I wanted to say with resolution. And we have also data distributions that may vary. We have, of course, in most cases, a normal distribution, or we can assume a normal distribution. But that might vary depending on specific things. Again, grades. In an ideal world, we have a normal distribution in grades. In most cases, it's not a normal distribution. It's a exponential graph towards the worst grades in most cases. Okay. That was more or less a repetition of last week, but we should repeat that. Now we get to the new stuff. First, we have to talk about what's a data object. A data object is basically one single data entry within a data set. So we can go back again to the transactional data set. One data object would be the transaction with ID 1 and the items bread, Coke, and milk. That would be one data object. Those data objects have multiple names, and you might see all of these names used in the practice. For example, a data object is also a sample. A data object is an example that's less used. It's an instance. Or in our context of the relational data sets, it's also called a tuple. That's especially often used in the database community. I don't think we have to go through specific examples because hopefully everybody knows what I talking about. The next thing is the attribute. That's not the row, that's the column of the table. That's also known as a variable, a feature, a field, or a dimension. I already talked about that during the course of dimensionality part. An attribute represents a specific characteristic of data object. For example, again, in our transactional data set, an attribute would be the column items. More commonly, of course, we have only one value per attribute. In this case, it's a multi-valued attribute. That's something you shouldn't use in databases most often because there is something like normalization basically normal forms. And it's against the first normal form, so the very basic normal form to have multiple values within one attribute, but that's another point to talk about another day. Okay. So we have data objects and attributes, rows and columns. What values might be in those attributes differs. And there are two different views on that. On one side, we can talk about the types of attributes. So basically taking a look at the attributes themselves. There might be categorical attributes. What are categorical attributes? Any ideas? Yeah. Sorry.
I don't know, but isn't like something like small, medium, large, like you can categorize it? Or is it like numbers, for example? Like you cannot measure them? Or
okay. Would numbers be categorical?
Numbers or like prop numbers or integer numbers. If you just do some category, that purpose number could be. But if we talk about the categorical data spatial, here we can take the example of roses. Like there are several colors of roses, like white rose, red rose, and it could be the categorical data.
Okay. Basically, that's right. I will repeat that for the camera up there, of course, but divided into parts. You already said that low, medium, high was the example. I'm not sure about it. I forgot about the concrete example used. But basically, categorical is we have categories, and items are only divided in a certain fixed amount of categories. For example, whatever your example was, I forgot about that, sorry, or colors for roses like you used. That are categories, and an attribute would be categorical if there's a certain fixed amount of categories we can divide the possible values into. The second part was whether numbers can be categorical. In most cases, they aren't, because there isn't a certain fixed amount of numbers in there. We have unlimited numbers in Fs. So that would be numerical, surprise, surprise. But if we say we have ages and divide ages of people into different categories, for example, the ages 1 to 18 are childs, and the ages 19 to 63 are adults, and above that are whatever, okay? Then, of course, we can create categories out of numbers. And it might also happen that a single number is a category, and therefore categorical. For example, the grades are a good example for that. Grades 1 to 6 are each a category for a certain performance in an exam. Numbers might be categorical, but most of the time they are numerical because they aren't limited. And in this category, we have two different kinds of numerical data, because we can be continuous, and we might be discrete. Integers are what?
Whole numbers, like 1, 2, 3,
those are integers. Yep. Whole numbers. And whole numbers would be more likely discrete. Again, it depends on the level of zooming. If you say it's the lowest level you can zoom in, of course, integers might also be continuous, so there aren't gaps between them. Continuous is there isn't a gap we can create. We can put something in between. Discrete is a certain steps, and there might be levels between that, but we do not record these levels. So those are basically the data types of attributes. However, the second possible view is that we can take a look at measurements. How are these values derived from our measured data? In that point, we can have two different divisions. We can have qualitative and quantitative data sets. Qualitative simply means that we do not provide any size of that measurement. So measuring your age wouldn't be a qualitative measurement, but it would be a quantitative measurement, because there's a size to that. Your age is 20, for example. A qualitative measurement is more something like you are very well spoken. That would be a qualitative measurement. I assigned a specific quality to your type of speech. While quantitative, again, are measurements with values attached to it, or with sizes or quantities attached to it. Quantitative is often used together with numerical attributes, of course, because how to otherwise talk about a size or a quantity. However, if the age groups are used, for example, which are more categorical, then we might also have a quantitative measurement with a categorical measurement attribute. So these things are pretty fluent between them, and we can always discuss whether something is, for example, a categorical attribute or a numerical attribute. It often depends on the use case. Below the level of qualitative and quantitative, we have another division, and we can talk about that in a different slide. Because below qualitative, we have nominal attributes. Nominal attributes are more or less categories. So again, some tendency towards the categorical types of attributes. For example, a hair color would be a nominal attribute. While an ordinal qualitative measurement is something that has a meaningful order to it. I wouldn't say that somebody who is blonde is better than someone who has brown hair. That's something you shouldn't say, because it's not something that is true. So there isn't a specific order to hair colors. While with an ordinal measurement, we have a meaningful order. For example, small, medium, large would be an example for that. There is a specific kind of nominal attributes we didn't talk about yet, and it's pretty important for the IT sector, because there are binary attributes, so zeros and ones, true or false. Those are considered a nominal attribute. Nominal measurement, sorry. I should divide through between those two types of measurements. There are binary attributes, and those are basically nominal. For example, sexes, those are binary, male and female. Again, there's no order attached to it. Also, you might attach, of course, a meaning to a specific binary attribute. For example, passing the exam, yes or no. I would say passing the exam is better than not passing the exam, of course. But basically, the attribute itself doesn't have a meaning, so it's more likely nominal. That's the division between nominal and ordinal. In the quantitative measurements, I do not think that I have. Yeah, I do not attach a slide for that, so we should talk about that as well. While we are in this quantitative spectrum, we have a size, a quantity attached to that. Of course, we might have some kind of interval. Again, ages, age groups, 1 to 18, that would be an interval. Or we can be in a ratio measurement. For example, 51% of students are male, and 49% of students are female. Just an example, that's not a true ratio, but just an example as a ratio, for a ratio. Okay. I did attach an example, if I just forgot about it. That interval scale attributes have measured in a scale and normally have equal sized attributes. While ratio scaled, yeah, have a 0 point. OK, we already talked about continuous and discrete, so I will skip it. Are there any questions regarding basic types of attributes or measurements? I guess it's pretty basic entry point. So next thing we can talk about are statistical measurements. I hope everybody knows most of them too. Why do we need statistical descriptors? We need them to basically gain a basic understanding of our data set. To gain knowledge about the tendencies in the data set, to gain knowledge about the variation and the spread of the data set. The most basic data dispersion characteristics are the median, the minimum, the maximum, the quantiles, and therefore also the quartiles, the outliers, and the variance. We will talk about them in detail after we discuss what a population is and what's a sample. A population is basically our whole data set. So every, or not our whole data set, because a data set might also be a sample. Better said, the population of all students in KDD are all students that registered for KDD. That's the population, all students. You sitting here in this, this lecture hall are basically a sample, because you aren't all students registered for KDD, but you are a specific subset of all students registered for KDD. That's a sample. So population are all possible data objects that fit into a category, while a sample is a specific subset. The subset might also be the whole size, whole group of that, but you wouldn't do that, basically. Why do we need those two different names for things, or different groups of data objects? The population of data objects might become very big. The population of all Google searches of all time is very, very, very big. If you do data science on the whole population of Google queries done in the whole time Google exists, it's that big that we can't possibly analyze that, at least with our technologies we have today. While if we derive a sample of that population, maybe we sample 2 weeks of Google queries, that's much easier to handle because it's less data. And that's true for all data sets. If we draw a sample, in the best case, a representative sample, then we can speed up our data science tasks. However, it becomes less precise, of course, if you only have a sample. And we should try to get a representative subset. So a representative subset of students isn't given in this case, because the students sitting here in the lecture are most likely students that put some more time into their lectures, into my modules, while the students staying at home are students that are more likely, not always true, to be less enthusiastic about the lecture. Sometimes I have speech disorders, sorry for that. But A sample like you wouldn't be representative for the whole population of KDD students, because you are more likely to have better grades in the exam. Not because me giving you out better grades, but you giving some of your time to being here in the lecture. And that wouldn't be representative if we would try to gain knowledge about the whole population of KDD students. But basically, samples are faster and are most likely not the perfect sample. With these samples, or if valid or if possible, also the whole population, we can now derive statistical descriptors. The most basic descriptor for central tendency, so whether we have more students on the lower spectrum or higher spectrum of grades, for example, is the mean. I guess everybody knows how to compute the mean. We just sum up every grade and then divide it through the whole count of samples or population data objects. For example, if we have 5 students, everybody has a different grade, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Then we would sum up 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 is 3, 6, 10, 15. Divided through the whole count of students, so 5 is 15 divided through 5, the arithmetric mean would be 3. That's pretty basic. Everybody should know that who studies at a university, I guess. The problem with that is, if there would be a student with, if there would be 4 students with a 1 and 1 student with a 5, this 1 student suddenly decreases the mean very, very drastically. And that's a big problem of a mean, because it's very sensitive to extreme values, which are called outliers. A variation of a mean might solve that. We can trim that mean. We can say everybody at the outer margins of our data set is discarded. So if, again, example, we have 1 student with a 1, we have 3 students with a 3, and we have 1 student with a 5. We can cut off the 1 and the 5 and just take a look at the middle population, middle sample. Of course, you shouldn't do that with only 5 samples. That would invalidate the samples, but we can trim the mean. The problem is that we have to find a good cutoff point. Who is telling us that good cutoff point? Nobody. It again depends on the use case. And trimming the mean is happening often, but it often is leading to lying statistics. Because if we cut off the lower incomes in a country, we can somehow modify our mean income in the country to our political ideas. And that's something you shouldn't do. Statistics can always lie, especially if you use something like trimmed mean. The next idea to measure the central tendency is not to compute the average of the mean, but to select the most medium and the data object that is lying in the middle of the whole data set. For example, if we have, and I will use something like that. Again, I will use the example for the grades again, because it's the simplest example. If we have students with 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 5, 5, 5, 5. Let's do that. The mean would be something like 2, 6, 9, 29 divided through 9. Oh God, 29 divided through 9. Whatever. Estimated. So mean would be. Let's stay with that. That's the result. No need to resolve the division. What would be the medium of that? A median of that? 3. Why? What is the middle of that? Or why is it the middle? Because we have 4 values below and 4 values above. So that's the middle. Because the middle, the mean might also be called the middle. But that's not true. One important part of the mean is that we might also have this case. What is the middle of that? The middle of that is somewhere in between here. So we have to compute the middle value of the two most middle values. So 2.5 is the correct answer for that. But basically, we are less sensitive to extreme values, because we now just count them. An extreme value like 101, which would be a pretty significant outlier in this case, just moves our median 1 point to the right. So we are less sensitive to outliers. Of course, that's not possible with grades, but let's stay with degrees, maybe. 101 degrees are also very significant, but yeah. The next problem, the next thing we have to talk about is how to compute the median for interval grouped. So for example, age ranges. If we have age ranges, now with a better division than I did earlier, and we now want to compute the middle and the median of these age groups. How can that be done? First, we have to know how many items are in each interval. We know that in the age group 1 to 5, we have 200 data objects. Or not data objects, but yeah, data objects. In the age group 6 to 15, we have 450 data objects. 6 to 20, 300, and so on. With that, we can compute the relative frequency. So, in percent, how many items are within that age group? 200 data objects of, in total, 3,149 items equal to roughly 6% of overall frequency. The same can be done for all the age groups. And of course, it should sum up to 100%. Otherwise, we would have done something wrong. That's not enough to get to the median. Because the next step is to sum up those frequencies. We know that the age group 1 to 5 is 6%. We know that the age groups 1 to 5 and 6 to 15 summed up are 20%. So the two relative frequencies summed up are equal to the age groups 1 to 15. So if we would merge to the two age groups. And we can do that until we for the first time crush the 50% threshold. Because in that age group, for the first time crushing the cumulative frequency of 50%, we know that the 15th percentile is contained. Okay, now we know that the median is in class 4. Because class 3 is just around 30%, and class 4 is 76%. So it's somewhere in this age group. But can we go one step further and estimate the true value of that median? So the median seems to be somewhere in the interval 21 to 50. But how can we estimate the median within that interval? And that can be done by assuming a normal distribution. If we assume a normal distribution, we can, of course, compute a concrete value. That, of course, can be done only with numerical values, because otherwise, how to compute an ordering within that group? At least the group has to have an internal ordering, which is most likely a numerical group. And in that case, we can compute the value by taking a look at the lower boundary of a group. In this case, the lower boundary is 21. Then adding 1/2 the sum of all absolute frequencies, so the 3,149, if I'm correct, divided through 2, so basically computing the mean of that group, minus the cumulative sum of all absolute frequencies below the class, so this one, just in the absolute part. And then, wrong direction. Then dividing through the amount of all the sum of the count of all values or data objects, and multiplying by with the width of the interval. So basically, let's take a look again at that. We have the lower bound is 21. We have a class width of 29. We know that 1,500 samples are in that. And we know that in total we have 3,149 samples. So we can do 21 plus 3,149 divided through 2. That's the total mean, not the mean, but the value where the mean should lie, basically, minus all values before. So we have 950 values before that group. And then we divide through the total amount of points in that, and then we basically compute the mean value of that group. Maybe I should split that up a little bit differently. If we take a look at the 21 plus part, and just ignore that for a little point. And now we are taking a look just at the this part. In this part, we basically compute the value where the mean should lie. So by dividing this 3,000 minus 950 divided through 1,500, we get to the ordering ID, or order number of the value we're searching for. And now we are multiplying it with the width of this interval, and we get to the value in that order, and now we just move it to be at the level. Okay, I don't think both explanations are helping. Just take a look at that at home, and maybe if there are questions, I will come up with a better explanation, less confused explanation next time. But basically, we can compute the median for that, which is basically the mean within the median group. Median group. We might have an other distribution assumed, and then we might have to alter that distribution assumption, of course. Well, what's the question?
Yeah, like kind of dispersed distribution, not uniform, not normal. Yeah.
We have to assume a distribution because within our original data set, we do not have information about the distribution. So we have to have expert knowledge about the assumed distribution. In most cases, we would assume a normal distribution, not a uniform distribution. A uniform distribution is pretty uncommon. A uniform distribution would be every possible category has the same amount of values in it. That's pretty uncommon in the real world. Normally, we would assume a normal distribution because a normal distribution is most often what we have after a certain while. But of course, if we have a sparse distribution, for example, and we know that we have a sparse distribution, due to expert knowledge, we can assume that. Then we shouldn't use that formula, of course. That's basically just an estimation. This value is most likely not the true median of that group. If that is a pre-processed data set and we have original data somewhere in our data store, we can, of course, verify whether that's true. In most cases, 33.95951 isn't the true median. That's just an estimation. And it should be treated as just an estimation. You can't tell your bosses that 33.51 is the true median of a group. That isn't true. A median would most likely not be at 0.51 at all. That's what I was talking about. Basically, this computation is a mixed form between a mean and a median, because we use the median to get to the group, but then we use methods more related to the mean to compute a an estimation of the true median. So it's more a combination of that. And that's basically what I wanted to tell you with that. But I've seen that this explanation isn't that good. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, of course.
All the Asian worlds are including the lower and the upper bound. So, for example, H1 to 5 shouldn't be with V5, but it includes 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah, that's basically a mistake on the slides. Yeah, you're true. Right. It should be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's a mistake. If you have time and no Git, just fix it on Git. No, I will do that. Thanks for that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But this alters the value a little bit because now it's multiplied with 30, of course. But it's in the same region. I'm pretty sure it's in the same region, and the computation itself doesn't alter. Okay. And the next point of central tendency, and I have to speed up now a little bit because my explanations take too long, we are at the mode. The mode isn't about the middle. It's about the most often occurring item. So in this example, the mode would be 5, because 5 is occurring most often. You can have only one mode. That would be a unimodal distribution. While you might also have two modes, three modes, and so on, and that would be either bimodal or multimodal if more than two nodes occur. Because we might have more than one or two most often occurring values. I don't think there are questions about that. I do not have to explain that further. You can just interrupt me if you have questions at any time. Let's again go back to the normal distribution. I've never shown you a normal distribution. It's just assumed that you know a normal distribution. A normal distribution is basically a curve like that. It can be computed by using this formula. And this normal distribution is often part of data sets, especially numerical data sets. However, it's normally just an assumption or an approximation of the true distribution. You won't find a perfect normal distribution in most cases, but an approximation of a normal distribution. In some cases, we might have not a normal distribution, but a positively skewed data distribution. Important, a positively skewed data distribution has the most values, so the mode, towards the negative, so towards the lower end of the distribution. While a negatively skewed data distribution is the other way around. We are more likely to have most values at the upper end of data. Those two data distributions are always telling us something if the assumed data distribution should be a normal distribution. If we know that something isn't a normal distribution or it shouldn't be a normal distribution, then, yeah, it's not telling us anything. But for example, with grades, that is a great example because grades should be a normal distribution, and most often we have a negatively skewed data distribution in most cases. So that's telling us either the students aren't learning enough or the exams are too hard. but we can derive some information out of that. The normal distribution has some specific things to use in assumed normal distribution. And we will use the normal distribution for multiple methods later on. For example, for outlier detection, this can be used. Within a normal distribution, we know that between the mean, we already know the mean. Okay, I can't point to things anymore because my battery is low, but I will use that thing instead. between the mean, we already know that, and the standard deviation, we will talk about that in just a minute. We typically have 68% of the measurements. So in that blue interval on the left graph, we have 68% of measurements between the standard deviation, the mean minus the standard deviation, and the mean plus the standard deviation are 69% of 68% of points. We also know that between the mean and two times the standard deviation, or the interval two times the standard deviation around the mean, let's call it this way, we have 95% of the data objects, and so on. So if we just take a look at, for example, three times the standard deviation interval around the mean, we catch most relevant points. 99.7% of data points. That would be a way of detecting an outlier. If we define everything beyond that margins is an outlier. You would not normally do that, but we can use that for example, trimming the mean also. What's a standard deviation? You should already know that from maths, but we have two very important measurements. We have variance. Variance is just how much values fluctuate around the mean. So we have a computation of a mean, and then we take a look at the average variation of values around that mean. However, that's to the power of 2, and therefore not as easy to interpret. Because if we have just a value range between 1 and 5 and have a variance of 14, we can't interpret that good. While if we have the standard deviation, which is just the square root of the variance, it might be 7, oh no, sorry, 7 isn't good, 3, and it's easier to interpret that we have a spread of 3 points in average around that point. This standard deviation is used in many statistical methods. Also, the variance is used in many of them, but both are closely related, so I wouldn't distinguish between them. And that explains this slide a little bit better, because if we are talking about variance, and variance is basically the spread, then of course, using that spread, we can basically lower the interval around that curve. I won't go into detail on that. Some other methods to measure the dispersion of data are, for example, the range. So the range of this data set would be 1 to 101. Because, that's the minimum and the maximum value, of course, and the interval between that. We also have quartiles. Quartiles are pretty easy to understand with box plots. We will talk about box plots in a minute, so I will push that to box plots. We have an interquartile range, which is based on quartiles, so I will also push that back to that. We can also talk about the five numbers summary, so the minimum, 1, the maximum, 101, the median would be 3 in the example right now on the blackboard or whiteboard. And then we again have quartiles, which I'm pushing back to the slide. And then we have outliers, which can be computed in different ways. But the most common way is 1.5 times the interquartile range, because it's easy to compute. Again, I will explain that after explaining box plots, which is here. A box plot is a specific kind of graph we can draw around that our data set. And, okay. Just had to restart. Okay. We have a graph lying on one axis. So we are just drawing one dimension, one attribute. Let's say we have 0 to 100 as values in that axis. Then we would just take a look at every value laying on that axis. Our median becomes the center point of the box plot. So this line in here, that's the median. It's also the second quartile, because quartiles are just divisions of the data points. And we have four quartiles, first, second, third, and fourth. Basically, the fourth is maximum and therefore not relevant to us anymore. But the second one is the median and also called second quartile, because it's the medium, a middle quartile. Below the second quartile, we have one half of all data points. Above the median, we have the other half of all data points. With the first quartile, we have 25% of all data points below the first quartile and 75% above. What's with the third quartile? Any ideas? 75% below, 25% above. Basically that. The quartiles are called quartile because quarters, so we have our data set divided into four quarters, and therefore we have 25% between each quartile of data points. Besides quartiles, we also have quantiles. Quantiles aren't divided into quarters, but divided into 1 point, so a 1% point. So we might have the 25th quantile, which is the first quartile. Basically, this is used in the box plot. We have, again, the median is the middle line. The first line of this box, the name box plot, is the point of the first quartile. The upper end of the box is the third quartile. So we know that everything that's displayed in blue right here is the interquartile range, the range between the first and the third quartile. So basically, within the blue, 50% of points are present, but the middle 50% of points. Understood? Below that, we have all other points. And above that, we have all other points. The lines going out of the main box of a box plot are going up to the so-called viscas. Viscas are basically the minimum and the maximum of a data set. I'm saying basically because outliers wouldn't be considered as part of the minimum and maximum. If we take a look at the data set down here again, then we would have maybe said outliers are 1.5% of the interquartile range. Let's do it completely with that. We have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 points. We know, let's do one more value in here. Then we know that the median is here, somewhere in between that. In between here. So here we have the second quartile. We also know that here is the third, and here is the third quartile. So we know that the interquartile range is basically this interval. Is that understandable? Now we know that the EQR is 1.5, 5 minus 1.5. So the size of the EQR is 3.5. Now we know that everything, and if we define now that the cutoff for outliers is 1.5 times the EQR, then we know that everything above 4.75 above the first quantile is an outlier. We know that 5 plus 4.75 is below 101. So we know that these two are outliers. And therefore, the viscas would go up to 5 up here, because outliers are considered part of the minimum and maximum. Is that explanation understandable? Okay. Most often you would use 1.5% the EQR, but there are other thresholds you can use for our outlier detection, for example, 3 times the EQR. If there's a question regarding that in the exam, we would, of course, define what interquartile range to use. In the box plot, outliers would just be points outside the viscas. So the 101 and 102 would just be points lying somewhere up here at the rightmost point of the box plot. We can have multiple dimensions, multiple attributes, for example, drawn as a box plot. In this case, we see that the viscas of average daily temperature in the months January to December vary. We see that the median temperature goes up in summer and goes down in winter. Surprise, surprise. We also see that the minimum temperatures are very low in winter, minus 12 degrees. However, we have some points below that. Those are the outliers we talked about. So a temperature of minus 20 degrees Celsius would be regarded an outlier in this context. Of course, it's always context sensitive. I guess in India, a temperature of 0 degrees Celsius would be regarded as an outlier. This is a pretty European temperature distribution. But with this box plot analysis, we can tell very much about the distribution of data in temperatures. We can have some other basic statistical descriptors. For example, we can have a histogram. We can have the aquantile plot, a quantile to quantile plot, and a scatter plot. Let's take a look at the histogram. Histogram should be known to everybody, I guess. A histogram is basically, we just sum up every value of points in our data set and just create, I don't know what's happening here. I can't point again. Okay. We just sum up points. We can do that with ordinal data, so data of the categorical measurements which have an order. And we can do that with numerical, either continuous or discrete. If we have discrete, we can just use the discrete buckets to sum up those parts. If we have continuous data, we can just grade buckets. So everything between 1 and 2 is maybe put into one bucket. And then we sum it up to grade those bars. And the histogram is just using that to draw a graph. Histograms often tell something more than box plots, because box plots just are telling us the minimum, the maximum, and the quartiles here, and maybe the outliers. While in a bar chart, we can see that this distribution and this distribution differ. We have two very specific maxima in here, while in this distribution we have only one maximum in the middle. So this is basically near to a normal distribution, approximate a normal distribution, but this certainly isn't. And I can tell you both of those graphs would look the same in a box plot, because the minimum and maximum are the same, and also the median and the first and the third quartile are also the same. So these distributions would look totally the same in the box plot. However, they aren't as easy to interpret. If I would have drawn that for this diagram, it would be pretty hard to read. The advantage is to both of them. The next thing is the quantile plot, where we just use to draw up the quantiles. So basically, we know that at a unit price of $0, we have 0% of values. At a at 20% of values, we have around a unit price of, let's say, $1, just an estimate, and so on. We know that at 0.8%, we have an estimate value about $30, just an estimation, which can be done by just drawing every quantile, for every quantile the value we are at. So first quantile is 1% of values, which value we are then. We can also compare two different dimensions to that using a quantile-to-quantile plot, which is just comparing two different dimensions to each other. And we can also take a look at single values, not quantiles, but single values, and compare two different dimensions to each other as well. Maybe we have age and salary, maybe. Wouldn't be a good scatter plot for that, but basically we draw every single value. For example, if someone is 21 and earns 20 euros per hour, then he would be this point, depending on the axis, of course. But we have no axis in here, so we will talk about these different graphs in the exercise, so I will go over that right now. You will draw them in the exercise through pandas, so you will get to know them in much more detail in the exercise. Let's talk about what data profiling is. Data profiling is basically collecting data about data, so metadata. If we take a look at a data set and derive a histogram out of the data set, that would be data profiling, because we take a look at the original data and derive a new data set, this one, out of the data. This is very important in data science, because by gaining new data from original data, we can create knowledge. Or not create knowledge, but get to know the knowledge. Because the knowledge is always there, but isn't explicit. Which is true for all data science or all KDD stuff. Everything is data profiling, basically. Because every time, whether we use frequent pattern analysis, whether we use classification, all these basic statistical methods, we always gain data about data. Let's go to the data visualization, because I want to talk about that at least a little bit today. Data visualization is basically what we have done with histograms and scatter plots and things like that. But there are more advanced methods of visualization, data visualization, which can be used, for example, to show your boss what you have done, what you have detected in the data. There are different kinds of visualization methods. For ones, pixel-oriented, geometric projection, icon-based, hierarchical, and other methods. Let's start with pixel-oriented techniques. If we want to talk about the income, we can just visualize the income with colors. So the darker the bar, the more data points are in that bracket. The lower incomes are pretty dark, so there are a lot of incomes at the lower end of a bar. While at the upper end, we have only white bar, so there are less people in that bar. For the transaction volume, we might have very least transactions at 1 cent, but we might have a lot of transactions at 10 euros, and we might have less transactions again at 100 euros. That's pretty common. The age is pretty messed up, because we do not just use bars in here. We just used little dots for every age. So let's say the age 1 is the lower left corner. Then the next is the H2, H3, H4, H4, 5. And in steps of 10, we go to the next level, for example. We can do that as well, but it gets pretty hard to read, because we just see ages are different, have different counts. I wouldn't be able to see something around that age in here. We can, of course, and that's the most commonly used method to show both distributions we had here, especially if we do not have an ordinal attribute, we might use a bar chart, just dividing the dimension, the values into different pie pieces, maybe. A pie chart is also what it's called often. It's of course often used maybe in political elections. You would use that to show how many seats a party has won and how much seats another party has won. We can also use polar charts. Polar charts are pretty special because they can show multiple dimensions at the same time. This polar chart would show 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 dimensions. For example, Pikachu, the orange blob in here, has a speed of 100 or nearly 100. He has a special defense of around 30. He has a special attack of estimated 50, and so on. And we can show multiple dimensions for Pikachu, but we can also show multiple Pokemon within that polar chart. And now we see easily that a Bulbasaur has a better special defense than a Pikachu. I'm not sure whether that's true, but I'm pretty sure that Mel, my colleague from last semester, did a good look up on that. So basically, that's what you can see in here. This is good to compare different tuples throughout different attributes. The next point are geometric projection visualization techniques. We already talked about one, scatter plots. We can also use scatter plots to compare different attributes, different dimensions slash attributes. Because if we just scatter the dimension one against the dimension one, of course, we do not get any scatter plot. It would be just a line. But if we compare the dimension one with the dimension two, then we get a scatter plot, and so on. And that comparison around a whole matrix, so comparing each attribute with each attribute, that's called a scatter plot matrix. We will do that with an example in the exercise as well, so no worries of me going through that in very high speed. You will get to know that in more detail in the exercise. We can have a parallel coordinate plot, which is basically this just with lines. Because we have different values at different dimensions, southwest maybe, or SW, SL, PW, PL, are all different attributes. And the different graphs or different lines are different tuples. So the tuple red 1 has a south W value of 2, has a south SL value of, 5 maybe, and so on. So it's basically similar to that, but with a 2D drawing. The next thing we can talk about is, of course, icon-based visualization, which is more business-like to show your boss your data with some icons. If we use one human pictogram as I think 1,000 students, we can show that the most students at FAU are within the TechFac, or Faculty of Engineering, and the Business Faculty, so the Faculty of Business Economics and Law. Those two are basically the biggest. Maybe the social sciences and theological is pretty close to that as well, but the smallest is the Faculty of Medicine. That's pretty easy to spot, and a more easy way to understand data, because everybody knows that a human pictogram seems to be some indication for human counts. If we would use maybe two different pictograms, one for male and one for female, let's stay with binary, because if we use non-binary, it will get messed up, and use just these toilet icons, then we can simply show our boss or whatever the stakeholder is, we want to show that pictogram, how many males and females are within that data set. There's another way of showing things with even more dimensions within one picture. That's called channel faces. That's something we can't use in KDD by ourselves, because Chernoff just told us that we can, within one face, encode a lot of different information. For example, we can encode the eye size, we can encode the nose size, we can encode, we encode a lot of different things within one pictogram. A lot of different dimensions within one picture. But it's very specific information. It's not an information we can use, or a pictogram we can use to transport grades to our boss. We just can use that to transport information around faces. But it's just an example to show you that it's possible for a very specific use case to use specific pictograms to show a lot of dimensions within one diagram. And the last thing I want to talk about today are tree maps and cone graphs. Tree maps are basically a dimensional way of showing distributions. Why dimensional? Hierarchical. Because we can just show that 68% of people are within A. We can show that 22% are within D, 5 and 5. But we can also split it up into another level of distributions. We can split up A into another four boxes, maybe, with a different distribution. And then it would get hierarchical. Tree maps are pretty good to show the amount of percentage, or the cumulative percentage of, not cumulative, the percentage of classes the classes have within a whole data set. For example, this might also be, local students at FAU, because I guess there are less than 40% of foreign students in most courses. Let's say that's what we show here. And the last thing I want to talk about are three-dimensional cone trees, which is basically, and I do not think this picture is showing that very good, but think about that like this. If we have a hierarchy, so maybe let's just do it with bosses and workers, okay? Let's say these nine down here are worker number one, worker number three, and so on. When we have triangles, basically, because a lot of workers are below one boss. But the boss might also have one boss for himself or herself. And if we span that up a lot of layers, we might end up with something like a cone. And put it in a three-dimensional space, of course. We might end up with a three-dimensional cone. And what can be done with that three-dimensional cone to make it easier to read is to look at that cone from above. Because then we can trace a path from worker 2 to the highest boss by simply drawing a path to the middle. Middle is the highest point. And that's pretty useful if you have a lot of data sets, data points. Most often that's used if you have thousands of nodes. Of course, there's a limit to that as well. If you have 1 million of points, it might be not enough to use that as well. But it's easier to use for those great amount of points, data points, than this tree map. If you have 1,000 points, drawing a tree map, or 1,000 different categories, drawing a tree map is pretty messed up. Then we can use a data cone. And we have non-numerical data. For example, we can use a text cloud. You might use as have seen that on websites, and we can use networks. That's basically what we have. On most of the data visualization techniques, we will talk, we will take a look in the exercise, so don't worry about that. If you have questions, of course, you can ask them now or in the forum. And we will start next week with this section of the lecture because I couldn't finish that. I talked about too much in too much detail on the statistical descriptors. Please remember that today the exercises start. So everybody who's assigned to the exercise group group two is on Monday. Don't forget that. Besides that, exercise groups 1, 3, and 4 are in the next days. Just remember that. Besides that, have a good week. See you next time next week.